Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
All this took place a long time ago, most likely some 2,000 years ago. There was a rich man who had a beautiful and pious wife, and they loved each other very much. Though they did not have any children, they longed to have some. Day and night, the wife prayed for a child, but still none came, and everything remained the same. Now, in the front of the house, there was a yard, and in the yard stood a juniper tree. One day, during winter, the wife was under the tree peeling an apple, and as she was peeling it, she cut her finger, and her blood dripped on the snow. "Oh," said the wife, and she heaved a great sigh. While she looked at the blood before her, she became quite sad. "If only I had a child as red as blood and white as snow." Upon saying that, her mood changed, and she became very cheerful, for she felt something might come of it. Then she went home. After a month, the snow vanished. After 2 months, everything turned green. After 3 months, the flowers sprouted from the ground. After 4 months, all the trees in the woods grew more solid, and the green branches became intertwined. The birds began to sing, and their song resounded throughout the forest as the blossoms fell from the trees. Soon, the 5th month had passed, and when the wife stood under the juniper tree, it smelled so sweetly that her heart leapt for joy. Indeed, she was so overcome by joy that she fell down on her knees. When the 6th month had passed, the fruit was large and firm, and she was quite still. In the 7th month, she picked the juniper berries and ate them so avidly that she became sad and sick. After the 8th month passed, she called her husband to her and wept. "If I die," she said, "bury me under the juniper tree."
That is the beginning of maybe one of the most horrible fairy tales I've ever had the pleasure of reading, The Juniper Tree, as recorded by the Brothers Grimm.
Horrible yet thrilling. I noticed you say you had the pleasure of reading it.
It was a pleasure.
I didn't know what to expect in this thing. There's no Disney version of this. There is a black and white Bergman-esque film with Bjork from the 80s, which kind of tells you something. But that movie does not even come close to approaching the Motel Hell vibe of this actual story. I am shocked, repelled, and I am also Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. Welcome to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
We're continuing to spotlight some selections from the fairy tales of the Brothers Grimm, and this week we are joined by reader Greg Johnson.
Greg is awesome. He does great voice work. He makes cool stuff. He makes videos of him making cool stuff. You can buy his cool stuff over on his Etsy page right now.
I will. Thank you, Greg. We'll also link out in the show notes.
Last week, we discussed Jakob and Wilhelm Grimm and their publishing of collected folktales. This week's tale came to the Brothers Grimm from the artist Philip Otto Runge. He was born in 1777. He did a lot of work in color studies and was one of the leading painters in the German Romantic movement. He's frequently compared to William Blake in his style, not just because of his painting, but because he wrote.
Yes, Philip Runge, this isn't a family Hassenflug joint like Snow White. It's told by a painter, and as such is more about potent imagery, I guess, than it is about teaching lessons or giving warnings about jealousy.
He sent the Brothers Grimm a version of the Juniper Tree that was written in Plattdeutsch, Low German, to give it an artless feel, as if this is a real story told by the common man, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
From what I've read, it's very little changed by the Grimms in their collection from what he delivered to them.
Von dem Machandelboom is the original title. And specifically, this was written in a Pomeranian dialect. Pomerania is a region around the border of Poland and Germany.
Uh-huh.
From what I can guess based on my education, it's ruled by dogs.
Yep.
That's a guess, but it is an educated guess.
Runge died of consumption in 1810 at the age of 33. God.
They had a secret consumption? Asked Edgar Allan Poe, who would have been one at the time. Developed his interests very early. Juniper Tree kind of sounds like a shady.com that I'd see a million ads for out of nowhere. Invest your money using Juniper Tree and let us sell your information so you can sleep soundly. But what is it really?
A juniper tree is a type of conifer tree with needles instead of leaves.
That's already scary. Needles instead of leaves? I've seen everything.
Juniper berries and sap have long been used to create medicines, so the juniper is often a symbol of healing and even rebirth. It's one of the oldest living species of trees on the planet, and it's actually really long-lived as well. The oldest living juniper tree is in the United States, and it's believed to be 6,000 years old.
Wow. I wonder how that specific juniper tree feels about this story, because it would have experienced life before and after it came out.
Oh. You know,
things were great before that story came along. Now all anybody wants to talk to me about is cannibalism and beheadings. I'm an old juniper tree.
Juniper trees survive in very harsh climates and are found all over the world. It's a very special type of tree.
For a very special type of story, why don't we just get into it?
Strangely, our story is set around 2,000 years ago, which would put it around biblical times, something I'm sure was intentional.
I love the variations of once upon a time that are in these stories. They don't all start with once upon a time. Sort of like a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away as a variation. Yeah. I always felt like once upon a time and that were just saying, hey, you don't know any of these people. The world was different. You can't apply modern lenses, modern rules, modern physics even.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's a little more, like in the opening to The Frog King, which is the very first story in here, it says, in olden times, when wishing still helped, which it does tell you you're going to hear a story with some magic in it, but it also tells you something about the post-Enlightenment world it was written in. The reader knows wishing isn't going to do anything for you. Rarely is that opening as specific as this by saying 2,000 years ago. So I think you're right that that is firmly rooted in, let's put this in biblical times, because this is sort of what it's about.
We have a happy couple, but they can't have children.
But they do have a juniper tree where the wife likes to hang out.
The woman cuts her finger, peeling an apple under the tree, and she sees the blood. This causes her to wish for a child that is red as blood and white as snow. Sound familiar?
I didn't really know anything about this going in. I read it directly after Snow White, and I thought, oh, maybe there's some connection. But apparently that's just a common type of wish, because it pops up again in some of these other stories.
This intro feels like a rehash of Snow White, and though it does have similar framing initially, the story is very different.
I want a kid whose flesh is white and whose hair is coal black. The Grimm's fairy tales is sort of setting the template for the goth.
Oh my god, yeah.
Type. This is what all of the Germans around the early 1800s are like, please give me a goth kid. But in the intro, we concluded with her asking to be buried under the juniper tree. There was a lot of imagery preceding that about the world renewing from winter into spring, month by month. And the next paragraph pays that off. She was quite content and relieved until the ninth month had passed. Then she had a child, as white as snow and as red as blood. When she saw the baby, she was so delighted that she died.
Delighted. The mother dying after childbirth, of course, was very common at that time.
Absolutely. And still more common these days than we would like to believe, I think. Yeah. But I wondered how many of those cases they chalked it up to delight, like in this story. I didn't know that delight could kill.
Well, there you go.
That's pretty potent stuff.
Her husband obeys her wish and buries her under the juniper tree.
By the way, the child that she had was a boy.
Mm-hmm. The father is sad for a while, but eventually he remarries and he has a baby girl, Marlena, with his new wife. We got us another wicked stepmother, and she hates the boy.
It presents this message: your parents love you unconditionally, but nobody else does.
Yeah.
They like their kids, and you need to understand that.
You think that, but she pulls some stuff on her own daughter later on.
Oh, I know.
Yow. So this evil stepmother beats the boy, and it's just generally cruel to him.
She pushed him from one place to the next, slapped him here and cuffed him there so that the poor child lived in constant fear.
Oh, God.
There's also more than just emotion at work. Whenever the woman looked at her daughter, she felt great love for her. But whenever she looked at the little boy, she could not forget that he would always stand in her way and prevent her daughter from inheriting everything, which was what the woman had in mind. There's some motivation.
Yeah.
Provided.
Still,
it doesn't justify what this woman is about to do.
No. One day, her daughter wants an apple, and evil mom gets one out of his chest. Marlena asks if her brother should have one as well. This is not cool with evil mom. She gets super pissed because, obviously, this girl cares about her brother. And she don't like that she cares about her brother because she hates that kid. And she goes, yeah, he can have one when he gets home from school. Sure. You know what? You don't get yours until then either. So she takes the apple back and puts it into the chest.
When she got the apple out for the girl, it says she gave her a beautiful apple from the chest that had a large, heavy lid with a big, sharp iron lock. When she's putting the apple back, just as she sees the boy rolling down the road on his way back from school, it presents an idea or opportunity to her. It says the devil seemed to take possession of her when she snatched the apple away from her daughter. So she puts it in the chest. She's kind of hatched a plan based on that sharp lock.
When the boy comes home, evil mom is giving him the stink eye and offers him an apple. The boy can see this evil look on her face, but he still takes her up on it because, you know, apple.
I fucking love apples. I just want to let you know. Sometimes you look at this, you go, why would they do it? I don't know. Apples are amazing.
They're really good.
I eat them almost every day.
They're good for you.
That's what they say. I hope so.
She tells him, take one out of the chest.
And as the little boy leaned over the chest, the devil prompted her, and crash! She slammed the lid so hard that his head flew off and fell among the apples. So, total decapitation.
Flew off.
Where did she get this lock from?
Evil mom is freaked out that she did this. It says the devil took her over. She's not sorry. She just doesn't know how she's not going to get into trouble for killing her stepson.
That line is brilliant, and the simplicity of it must come from that low German language. Because it says, then she was struck by fear and thought, how am I going to get out of this? Like, that's in the text. The stuff with the devil, though, it really is something like that. Almost like she's possessed, because this is a semi-impulsive act. She continues with her evil actions in the story, as we're about to see. But I know she wants to protect her daughter's inheritance. It goes so beyond that. She's simply a bad person. Yeah. And I think that was in some ways the surprise to me as I was reading this. In these folktales, lots of things are inscrutable. Plot points. Mm-hmm. But generally, motivations are not. You know, the queen is mad at Snow White because she's hot and she's going to replace her. And, you know, you kind of see why people want to do what they want to do. What happens next in the story here was beyond my comprehension.
Oh, my God. The mother gets an idea. She takes a kerchief and ties it around the boy's neck and sits him up in a chair. Oh, it's so f***ed up.
She's tied his head back onto his body. Yeah.
Yeah.
Somehow there's not blood everywhere shooting out. Gives him an apple, just pretending like none of this happened. He's just sitting there with his ascot on, like he's Fred from Scooby-Doo. The little girl talks to the boy, thinking he's alive, asks him for the apple. He doesn't respond for some reason, so she goes to the mother.
And she tells the daughter, look, if he doesn't give you the apple, slap him in the face.
In the text, it says, if he doesn't answer you, give him a box on the ear.
Oh,
so not to slap his face, but hit him with your fist on the side of the head. Oof. So she is definitely angling for a certain effect.
Marlena can see something isn't right, but does what her mother asks of her. And when he doesn't respond, she boxes him in the ear, knocking his head clean off. Marlena freaks out. She just bawls. And like a real kid would. I mean, if you think you just killed your brother.
Yeah.
And she's a good kid because she cares about him. Oh my God, that she did this thing. And then her mom comes in and says, look what you did. Like reinforces this idea. This whole thing is set up to make her daughter guilty of something that she didn't do.
Make her guilty in order to recruit her as an accomplice, I suppose, in what they're about to do. But also, it's a cruel trick. I got the feeling that the effect of it delighted her in some way. Yes. Why didn't this delight kill? I stopped reading at this point because I just had to tell people what was going on in the story. I was like on the phone. You guys, check out what this woman, this little girl just boxed her brother's head off. I couldn't believe it. Especially because with little kid logic, you really might think, I hit my brother so hard his head rolled off.
Oh, yeah.
As an adult, if you knock a kid's head off, you have a pretty good idea. It was pre-cut.
Yes.
But she doesn't know how the world works yet. She says, oh, mother, I've knocked my brother's head off. And she wept and wept.
The cruelty of this, that it's an innocent child, that she doesn't care about her feelings. This is the kind of thing that would scar a human for life.
Oh, I think so. She wants to secure her inheritance, but otherwise doesn't care about her.
Yeah.
At least they come up with a good solution.
Yeah. You think, okay, that's probably the worst thing about this story.
Yeah.
Buckle up, Buttercup. She tells her daughter, I'll keep it secret that you killed your brother, but I'm going to need your help to get rid of the body. I've got a perfect idea for this. Let's make him into a stew.
She clearly listened to our Lamb to the Slaughter episode and knows how to cover this up. Mm-hmm. Except instead of feeding the murder weapon to somebody, you feed them the murdered.
The mother took the little boy and chopped him into pieces. Next, she put them in a pot and let them stew. But Marlena stood nearby and wept until all of her tears fell into the pot, so it did not need any salt. This is some Texas Chainsaw Massacre stuff right here.
But at least they're seasoning their food. And we get that little insight into ancient culture.
This serving of people to their loved ones has some mythic origins. Artus made a banquet, his enemy Thyestes, feeding him his own sons. There's also some correlation to Osiris being chopped up and then being reborn, Orpheus being torn apart by the Maenads. Even in Shakespeare's Titus Andronicus, Titus kills two men who violated his daughter, butchers them, and then feeds them to their own mothers. The dad comes home and asks where his son is. Evil mom says that he's gone off to stay at his great uncle's house very far away.
Dad is authentically upset. What's he going to do there? He didn't even say goodbye to me.
Evil mom serves the junge Eintopf, which is boy stew, and poor little Marlena is just bawling her eyes out this whole time. For some reason, I feel it.
Yeah.
Sometimes in these fairy tales, they get over stuff really quickly, but Marlena does not. The trauma is real.
And she thinks that they're doing this to dispose of her crime.
The dad is sad that his son didn't even say goodbye, but this stew is awesome. He says, "I'm not going to share this with you. Somehow it feels as if it were all mine." After the father eats all the soup, Marlena, crying the whole time, I don't blame her, takes her brother's bones, ties them in some silk, and buries them under the juniper tree. And she instantly feels better and stops crying.
Now the juniper tree began to move. The branches separated and came together again as though they were clapping their hands in joy. At the same time, smoke came out of the tree, and in the middle of the smoke, there was a flame that seemed to be burning. Then, a beautiful bird flew out of the fire and began singing magnificently. He soared high in the air, and after he vanished, the juniper tree was as it was before. Yet the silk kerchief was gone. Marlena was very happy and gay. It was as if her brother were still alive, and she went merrily back into the house, sat down at the table, and ate.
Again, I didn't see that coming. I thought maybe the tree would get reanimated and some kind of evil dad action would happen.
Yeah, I thought maybe the mom was going to come back or something like that.
Oh, right, yeah, because she got asked to be buried under the tree. Yeah.
There is some symbolism with the birth mother being the source of good and the...
Right.
That's her place of power, is this tree. But she was able to help because she's the pure mother.
Because she's there, perhaps she's able to do the alchemy necessary to change this kid into a bird?
Yeah. And of course, this ties into the myth of the phoenix from Greek culture, the bird that makes its nests and then bursts into flames and is destroyed but comes back new.
And there was that whole passage marking the months of springtime in the beginning. And I think the implication, maybe, is that you can't bury bad deeds. They will spring up. Spring back and get you.
The bird flies over to the goldsmith's house and sings the song.
My mother, she killed me. My father, he ate me. My sister, Marlena, she made sure to see my bones were all gathered together, bound nicely in silk, as neat as can be, and laid beneath the juniper tree. Tweet, tweet, what a lovely bird I am.
This thing has a rhyme scheme and just seems like a spooky bird poem.
Uh-huh.
But then that last line, tweet, tweet, what a lovely bird I am. It's just such a strange emotional change and capper to the stanza. It's really unsettling.
It's bizarre. It's so bizarre. The goldsmith goes outside with a gold chain that he was working on, and he is astonished by this kick-ass song. He asks the bird, please sing it again. But the bird says, I don't sing a second time for free. Give me that gold chain and I'll do it again. The goldsmith is so into the song that he agrees and he throws the bird the chain. The bird fulfills its promise and sings the song again, and it's off, this time to the shoemakers. The bird sings the song again.
My mother, she killed me. My father, he ate me. Tweet, tweet, what a lovely bird I am.
The shoemaker loves the song. He gets his wife, the kids, the maid, everybody to go out and see this awesome bird. And it's shredding song. The shoemaker asks to hear the song again, but the bird says, I don't sing it twice for free. Give me something. So the shoemaker thinks, and he tells his wife, go upstairs, get these sweet red shoes. She does, and he gives them to the bird, and it sings its song again. And after that, it flies away. So it's got red shoes in one claw, gold chain in the other. Red and gold are colors associated with the phoenix.
And we're also getting back into these patterns the stories like to set up. You know, they're going to use the rule of threes here, basically. Mm-hmm.
Now the bird goes to the mill, and there are 20 dudes working hard, and he sings his song. They all become enraptured. They want to hear it again, but the bird has a cost for round two of the song, and he wants the millstone.
I had to think about what I knew about millstones. In my mind, I'm going, isn't that a huge thing?
Yes.
How big is this bird? That doesn't seem like something a bird is going to be able to carry, but that doesn't matter in this story.
I've seen some smallish millstones, but there's like 20 dudes working at this place, so it's got to be huge.
It's huge.
Minimum 3 feet across, a foot thick, probably bigger than that. But the bird wants it, and it's a magic bird, so, you know, whatever. Yeah. They all agree to give the bird the stone, and this thing is heavy, and yet the bird just pokes its head through the middle of it, and it can carry it. It sings its song again. Everybody's happy, and off it flies. Gold chain in the right talon, red shoes in the left, and the millstone around its neck.
Right, which would be all you would see. In this fairy tale land, there's just a giant flying rock hovering over the land.
Yes. The bird returns to the father's house. Father's feeling great, but evil mom is feeling horrible. Something is really wrong.
Yeah.
And Marlena is back to crying and feeling terrible. The bird begins to sing its song.
And the dad is hypnotized by the song. He loves it. Even though it's talking about my father, he ate me. He doesn't know this yet, though, does he? He thinks his kid is still gone. Oh, mother, says the man, listen to that beautiful bird singing so gloriously. The sun's so warm and it smells like cinnamon.
And I think this is a reference to the phoenix is said to make its nest that it burns itself up and is reborn in. Its nest is made out of spiced twigs and bark, and cinnamon is one of those things.
I think that's exactly what it is, because this beat is all about, I'm anticipating that my payback is coming. She feels bad, but doesn't know why yet.
Yes. Evil mom is holding her head in agony, and Marlena is crying her little eyes out still, the poor kid. But the father is filled with joy, and he goes out to see this bird. After the song, the bird drops the gold chain and it falls right around the father's neck. And he's like, whoa, not only do I get to hear this amazing song, I get a free gift from an awesome bird. I feel awesome. Evil mom is on the floor. She's petrified.
This must be what that guy from Full House feels like whenever he hears that Alanis Morissette song. He knows it's about him.
What? What are you talking about?
You don't know what I'm talking about?
No.
I'm just going to leave that there. Let's finish out the story. I'll come back around to it.
The bird sings its song again. This time, Marlena feels the need to go outside and see the bird. The bird drops the red shoes for her, and she feels great again.
I don't care what gifts the bird gives me. I'm going to wonder about the giant millstone around its neck. But the mother, she's not worried about that because she just knows this is all bad for her, listening to the lyrics of the song. The woman was petrified and fell to the floor. Her cap slipped off her head, and the bird sang again. My mother, she killed me. Oh, I wish I were 1,000 feet beneath the earth so I wouldn't have to hear this. My father, he ate me. Then the woman fell down again as if she were dead. Tweet, tweet, what a lovely bird I am.
Marlena felt gay and happy. She put on the new red shoes and danced and skipped back into the house. Oh, she said, I was so sad when I went out, and now I feel so cheerful. That certainly is a splendid bird. He gave me a pair of red shoes as a gift. Not me, said the wife, who jumped up and her hair flared up like red-hot flames. I feel as if the world were coming to an end. Maybe I'd feel better if I went outside. As she went out the door, crash! The bird threw the millstone down on her head, and she was crushed to death. The father and Marlena heard the crash and went outside. Smoke, flames, and fire were rising from the spot. And when it was over, the little brother was standing there. He took his father and Marlena by the hand, and all three were very happy. Then they went into the house, sat down at the table, and ate.
Wow.
Dad's not like, why aren't you at our relative's house? Why did you just come out of an exploded millstone? forget it. Let's get something to eat. That's the end of the story.
That's it.
The boy is reborn out of this murder.
Like the phoenix.
Like the phoenix. At first, I didn't know the boy was going to show up again. When the bird dropped the millstone, I thought it just exploded. Like, did the bird wire this thing up? I didn't know millstones, you know, burst into flame when they were dropped.
That's atypical, this version of the story. Most of the other versions of the story, the kid does not come back.
Really?
He's just the bird and that's it.
Oh, okay.
The millstone might be a biblical reference. Matthew 18, verses 5 and 6, it says, And whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me. If anyone causes one of these little ones, those who believe in me, to stumble, it would be better for them to have a large millstone hung around their neck and be drowned in the depths of the sea.
Aha. Yeah. It definitely harkens to that.
Yeah. Now, this story, like I said, has other similar folk tales. One of them's called The Rose Tree. It's an English story. The older child is a daughter, and the stepmother cuts her head off, feeds her father her heart and liver in a stew. On the rose tree, a white bird appears. We've got the chain as well, the shoes, the millstone, all the same. And there's a Scottish version called Pippity Pew. And here's the song from that one. Pippity Pew, my mammy me slew. My daddy, me ate. My sister Kate gathered all my banes and laid them between two milk-white stains. So a bird I grew, and away I flew, sing pippity-pew.
What?
So this is like a real common story. It's spread all over Europe. And both of those stories, like I said, the kid does not come back.
How odd that that song is so similar to the one in this story. So clearly this has gone through tons of iterations, but I don't, I guess I don't really understand the hook other than it's the stepmother kills this kid and serves him to his father. And that's the hook of the story that people repeat.
That's the hook.
I don't know if you knew this, but the Alanis Morissette song, You Oughta Know, is said to be about Dave Coulier from Full House.
Dave Coulier?
Yes. You didn't know that?
No.
When she's talking about going down in theaters and stuff, that's Dave Coulier probably doing a Bullwinkle impression while that's happening. Well,
God.
You know, I don't know if that's been disproven or if she's copped to it, but that's what apparently that song is about.
Wow.
So he, when Dave hears You Oughta Know, he has a reaction like this mother. This song's about me. I wish I were 100 miles under the ground so I didn't have to hear it. Speaking of songs, you know there's an opera about the juniper tree.
No.
This specific story by Philip Glass.
What?
Which surprised me. Like, Howard Shore doing his opera on the fly? Is this what all famous Hollywood composers do? They cash their checks so they can write operas about gross stories? It's so surprising to me.
People love opera. There's a lot of opera that goes on.
There is.
If you start looking for it, you'll see it. It's there.
It is home of nonsensical plots. So I guess, you know, grim fairy tales do fit in there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Of course, you mentioned the movie in 2002, The Juniper Tree with Bjork in it, that came out in America. I remember seeing it in the theater. I loved it. I thought it was great.
In 2002?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they did a restoration of it. In fact, I think they did that here in Madison, but I haven't seen it. You liked it?
Yeah.
It was shot in the late 80s, and then they had some troubles with it, and it didn't come out until 1990. It was well-reviewed, but then it kind of died for a while, I think, till Bjork had a resurgence, because she was only like 21 years old in that movie.
Oh, yeah. She looked really young. I watched a clip of it on YouTube because I hadn't seen it in a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was a child star in Iceland, you know, so she'd already been working as a singer for a long time. I haven't seen it. I called it Bergman-esque because that's what the trailer reminded me of. But did it follow? I know that there's witchcraft in it, and it doesn't really follow this, does it?
I don't remember, to be completely honest with you. It's been, you know, 20 years since I've seen it.
I spun off from this story and read another one that was recommended to me called The Dog and the Sparrow, which is the John Wick of Grimm's fairy tales. This sparrow befriends a dog whose owner has been beating him. The dog's like, I got to get out of this situation because I'm abused. Mm-hmm. And the sparrow's like, I'm going to hook you up. Come with me. He finds him something to eat, finds him a place to stay, does all these nice things for the dog. He's just his buddy. And then some guy's rolling down the road and runs over the dog feelinglessly. I don't care. The dog's on the road. I don't care. And the sparrow exacts revenge on this guy. That's most of the story. It's very video game-like in that he pecks the horse's eyes out from the guy's carriage. So the guy swings his axe to kill the bird, but the bird dodges at the last minute, and he ends up killing the horse. And there's three horses, and this happens three times. It's like the controller of the, you know, the sparrow figured out the pattern, like Mike Tyson's Punch-Out or something. This sparrow exacts so much revenge. It was like a really entertaining read because it's this little bird just kicking ass. But he uses all his little bird powers to do it. He's not hauling around a millstone or anything like that.
No.
I highly recommend The Dog and the Sparrow as a read.
Well, I gotta check that
out. Just like I guess I recommend this one because when people say, oh, those Grimm's fairy tales are, you know, they're a lot worse than you think. I think a lot of times they're talking about the red hot shoes, say, in Snow White. Well, here's another story for you.
It's pretty rough.
But a good one.
But wonderful. Yeah. I really enjoyed it. It's really great.
What made you pick this one out?
I remembered the Bjork movie, and there was a list of Christmas-ish Grimm fairy tales, and this one was in it, and it said it was kind of tentative. So I read it because I remembered seeing the movie years ago. And I just liked it so much that I stuck it in. It's really not Christmassy at all.
Yeah, what prankster did that? There's no Christmas going on here.
No, nothing. None of them really are very Christmassy. You know, Snow White's got some snow in it.
But it is definitely more of a springtime story.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. So that's why I picked it. But I'm glad
you did. Because I am going to be telling people about this story for a long time, I think.
I want to thank Greg Johnson for being an amazing reader. Please go check out his Etsy page. Throw him some of your dough. Get something cool.
I'm so delighted by the things that Greg does. I'm worried about my health. I also want to thank some patrons who I'm very delighted to have listening to the show. And I'm going to start by thanking Tyler Moody.
I want to thank Jake.
Mark McCartney, thank you.
Seth Mineta, thank you.
Lucas Bapple, thank you.
Ian McDaniel, thank you.
Francisco Vargas, thank you so much.
I'd like to thank Alex Shields.
Eric Wong, thank you.
And lastly, I'd like to thank Stephen Young.
Well, that's all we have on the Jupiter tree. What do we got lined up next?
Next week, it's all about the elves. We're doing one story, Shoemaker and the Elves, but there's... It's not just the Shoemaker. There's a bunch of elf stories kind of glumped together. And then, because you asked for Pfeiffer, and I can't say no to you, Rumpelstiltskin.
Yes. I love Rumpelstiltskin. That was my fave story growing up from this collection. Wonder how it'll revisit.
We're going to find out next week.
We'll be talking to you then. For now, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Exclusively on me.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.